This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Alan Scott. This is the place where government actions meet business decisions, both online at www.bgov.com and on the air Thursdays at 11 or Fridays at 2:30 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Hey, guess what? It's an election year, so the candidates are doing whatever they can, well, of course, within the constraints of the law, to get your money. Campaigning isn't cheap, you know. This is kind of where the super PAC becomes a handy tool in the candidate's arsenal, but are the super PACs at this point beginning to wag the dog, making those decisions on behalf of the candidate? Well, Melissa Avstrey is a legislative analyst with BGov, who's written a study about a possible shift in campaign strategies prompted by super PAC money. She'll join us along with Dr. Peter Brusso, who's got more campaign finance stuff in his head than allowed by law. He'll dispense that shortly. But we'll begin the program with a sequestration update. Last week, the president released his report on how much will likely be cut, but not so much about where at this point. Is that good? Bad? I don't know. Joining us is federal business analyst Dr. Kevin Brancato and transportation analyst Matthew Hummer to kind of break it down for me. Gentlemen, thank you for being here.
It's great to be here.
Yep, great, Alan. Thanks.
So back in August, Congress passed that Sequestration Transparency Act. According to the administration, this was to identify the reductions at the program and account level. Did this happen?
No.
Good, because I thought I was missing it.
No, in reality, it didn't happen. Congress wanted a report from the president that said how much of the $109 billion in cuts, half to defense, half to non-defense, that were supposed to occur on January 2nd at each and every program. So they wanted to know, let's say, fighter jets, by type of fighter jet, for ships, each and every ship, how much would come from each program, from NASA, space launches, how much would come from each and every one. And the administration responded with a report, which is lengthy. It's 400 pages, but not at that detailed level. It would identify cuts for, say, every single research and development program lumped into one bucket and how much would be cut from that. But that's not how sequestration is going to be implemented on January 2nd.
The level of granularity still isn't there, but we're still not talking at this point about building half a ship or half an airplane. That's not likely to happen.
No, they can't build half an airplane. And by law, they can't build half a ship. But what that really means is by law, they have to have in a given fiscal year's budget, if they want to build a ship, they have to have full funding for that ship, unless there is a specific dispensation, like for an aircraft carrier where there's a lot of money and they can incrementally fund this over time. But for something like aircraft, they could just lower the number of aircraft they would buy.
Right. So F-35 may not necessarily roll out the 500 or however many that were originally agreed upon. We're looking at a reduced number potentially.
Yeah, the administration itself estimated 4 fewer of them, but it didn't say which ones. There's 3 different variants.
So here's something interesting. Former Defense Secretary Robert Gates and former Joint Chiefs Chairman Admiral Mike Mullen this past Monday, pretty outspoken. At the Center for Strategic and International Studies, talking about the need for, and I'm doing the air quotes, adults to return to D.C. after the election. Of course, we're considering the sources here. They went on to say, Mullen, that is, he said he was worried sick about sequestration. Gates suggested that lawmakers get out of their ideological cocoons. And he went on to compare, and I think I've heard this before. I'm not quite sure where. Kevin, you might be able to remind me. But he went on to compare the current state of affairs to a scene from Blazing Saddles, you know, the one where the new sheriff holds the gun to his own head and threatens to shoot.
Oh, yes. That's my colleague, Rob Levinson. He said that on this program a couple
right.
of months ago.
That's right.
And he's been saying that repeatedly, but now, of course, his thunder has been stolen. He can't use that anymore. But, I mean, jokes aside, apparently they have more jokes than they do plans.
Right.
And that's really an issue here when we're heading into several months from sequester, the beginning of the fiscal year, just a couple of weeks away, and companies don't know which programs are going to be hit, whether their contracts are going to be hit. And all we've really heard out of the Pentagon is it's devastating, it's bad, it really shouldn't happen. But I think companies at this point want to know what's going to be cut, what won't. That sequester report didn't have any examples or any hope that a resolution would would occur.
Well, let's talk about that. You've both had an opportunity to kind of digest the report at this point. Were there any surprises, any changes, anything? And to blow BGov's horn, especially the FBI team, Federal Business Intelligence team, you guys nailed it. I mean, this thing was pretty much dead on. But outside of that, were there any surprises? What did you glean from it?
Actually, on our side, I really don't think there were very many surprises. We were hoping for more detail. We had estimated that on the defense side, cuts would be about 9.6%. The administration estimates now 9.4%. Fundamentally, there's very little difference. But what they didn't identify was how much of prior year funds would be cut and where those prior year funds hadn't been obligated. And that's a big question mark. Other than that, all the assumptions that we had made, that military personnel would be exempt, that essentially cuts would have to be made straight away across the board, that's what the administration has said. So there were no surprises fundamentally. They did identify specifically that all Veterans Affairs funding would be protected from sequester. It's exempt. Right. There was some question in the law whether or not administrative expenses for managing programs, which would their contracts at VA for that, would be sequestered.
Healthcare
by the administration.
As well.
Healthcare as well. But the administration has decided to exempt that, at the same time saying that they didn't really have any decisions they could make themselves. It was their interpretation of the law that they had to do this.
Right. So Matt Hummer, you penned a government insight, BGov insight, entitled Highway Spending to Escape Sequestration Cuts. I guess I'm going to ask you the same question. Were there any surprises? And if not, why did the highway spending not bear the brunt of the axe?
Right, yeah. As Kevin said, it wasn't as clear as we'd hope, but transportation is a different beast, and we actually had an idea of what was coming down the pipe. And being that it is unique, we estimated that about 80% of all transportation funding would actually be off the sequestering table. Mm-hmm. And that's largely because of a legislative language called obligation limitation. And I'd be happy to describe that. Basically, what that means in the transportation world is states rely on federal funding to be there for their long-term transportation planning. And obligation limitation does that. So when you set funding within those levels, that actually is exempt from the sequestration. So we knew that ahead of the OMB report that that'd be protected, and then after the report, that's exactly what happened.
So, and to credit you as well, your insight was released the day before the report actually hit. And again, no real changes. You guys nailed it.
Yeah, that took guts.
Yeah.
It's like, I know this is coming soon. I should probably release it now.
Yeah, it was a little bit of a bold move, but we're happy to say they were pretty much right. There is a little wrinkle that is quite the small thing that is a little bit different that we didn't really anticipate. And that one thing is because of the recent reauthorization of the law and it relying on a transfer from the general fund, actually $18.8 billion worth of money coming from the Treasury's general fund into the Highway Trust Fund, that money or a portion of that money is actually subject to sequestration. And the OMB report identified about $471 million in this coming fiscal year. And so of that money, some of that amount is actually open to the axe.
So if I can understand this right, that transportation fund basically is depleted every single year and it needs new money?
Right, and exactly. And so this is another issue that you raised, thank you, Kevin, is that because they're sequestering some of that money, the Highway Trust Fund will actually be depleted even faster than the lawmakers anticipated when they signed that law into.
Hopefully it's not the amount of money that would be needed for the lawsuit that I plan on opening after discussing this with Matt in a car ride earlier. I know he noticed that I had some kind of rocks that may have hit the windshield, probably from loose gravel, told me who I need to talk to. Hopefully those funds haven't been sequestered.
I don't think so. All federal aid highway programs are actually off the table, as well as transit programs and safety programs, as well as the FAA's program to improve airports.
Good deal. Good deal. I'll be filing that later today. In the meantime, we're speaking with Dr. Kevin Brancato and Matthew Hummer about sequestration. A nice little update to bring us up to speed now that the Office of Management and Budget has told us how much money will be sliced. They haven't really specified where that cut is going to happen. But Kevin, tell me about some non-discretionary spending. Do we have anything, any updates in that area?
Non-discretionary spending is going to be cut by about 8.2%, according to the OMB report. Bloomberg government had estimated 9.1%. Mm-hmm. There are just several different changes in the base. But we were interested primarily not how much each of the agencies would be cut. It's important. But what the contractors spend would be across that. And we think that's roughly equivalent to what we had seen, because there are some non-defense agencies like Health and Human Services that have substantial amounts to be cut from non-defense discretionary spending, but even agencies with smaller budgets like NASA, but get more of their budgets from contract spend. that really do take a hit. We didn't see any real tremendous surprises there. And I would think that the largest issues are just the same thing across defense and non-defense. Don't see that there is going to be any particular exemption that we weren't expecting before.
Let's talk continuing resolution. It's on the table. Nothing has happened at this point. Matthew, anything in your world that a CR would benefit or destroy?
Sure. Yeah. It's interesting. What the continuing resolution actually does is continue forward current funding, mm-hmm. as well as provide a little bit of a bump for inflation, at least that's what lawmakers are calling it. But it turns out in the transportation world and in transportation funding, that bump does not apply, or at least it doesn't as it stands. That is largely because of a technical legislative issue. So lawmakers on the Senate side are fighting for that, for spending to increase, while the House, you know, they're the ones that authored or penned the CR, so they're kind of holding off at this point. So we'll see politically what actually happens.
Kevin?
There's a very strange thing that happens for defense and sequester. They appear to be essentially appropriating more than the sequestration, than the Budget Control Act mm-hmm. would have allowed for this. So the amount that's going to be sequestered on January 2nd, if the current CR goes through, it may be a little bit more than they were expecting to get them back down to the cap. Because the caps is still in effect. The CR does not say, as far as I've seen, notwithstanding the Budget Control Act, here's how much we want to spend. It just right. says, here's how much we're going to spend. Sequestration is going to cut from that continuing resolution if it becomes law. And so there, it doesn't really change things. The big problem with the CR from the military's perspective and from the contractor's perspective is no new starts are permitted. So if you're building a ship that you didn't build last year, can't do it. Can't do it under the CR. It's not authorized. If you plan to build more of something than you did last year, can't do it. You're only allowed to do what you did the previous year. If your plans have been a radical change from the previous year, mm-hmm. you can't start it. And so there are fixes that will be required if contracts are supposed to be signed early in the year. But then again, this is during right at the end of this year, during perhaps during a lame duck session, depending on this bunch of time after the beginning of the fiscal year and then the lame duck session. Lots of things got to get fixed. This may be pretty low on the priority list.
Well, only time will tell as the sequestration clock continues to tick. Dr. Kevin Brancato is his name. To my left, to my right, it's Matthew Hummer. Gentlemen, thank you for joining me. So it's 2012, and the big story of the year is still unfolding. We're talking about the presidential election. You've seen the campaign ads. We've all seen them. They're all over the TV, all over the radio, billboards, lead stories in the news about who bashed who and what they had to say and what it means in the polls. Well, all that stuff costs money. Without money, campaign message isn't going to go very far. So a candidate can do a couple of things. Raise money on their own, but the most lucrative form of fundraising, so to speak, is through a super PAC, independent of the candidate. Joining me to further dissect campaign donations are a couple of people who are no strangers to this program. Data analyst Dr. Peter Brusso, and of course, legislative analyst Melissa Avstray. Hello.
Hello.
Thanks for joining me again. Hey, so last time you guys were here, we discussed about how companies are shying away from super PAC donations, kind of resulting in a minor role that they're playing in the elections. New study at this point, super PAC money prompts shift in campaign strategies, leads me to believe we're talking about a wag the dog situation, but I'm thinking I'm wrong. Melissa, explain.
Sure. So thanks for having me, Alan. So like you just said, we have just published a new study, and our new study is focusing on the presidential election. And what we looked at is how much is being spent by super PACs and mm-hmm. other outside groups, and really the impact that this outside spending is having on candidate campaign strategies, particularly what candidates are choosing to spend their money on.
Okay. So purpose of this was basically to outline just that.
Yes.
What they're spending their money on. Hundreds of super PACs registered now for the 2011, 2012.
Over 500.
We're really talking about a couple of big ones at this point, correct?
Yes. Yeah. There is, each of the candidates has a super PAC that is backing them. Mm-hmm. Restore Our Future is the pro-Romney super PAC, mm-hmm. and Priorities USA Action is the pro-Obama super PAC. And, you know, to be perfectly clear to the listeners, like you said in the beginning, these super PACs are prohibited from mm-hmm. coordinating with the candidate. So everything they're doing on their own.
Well, let's crack this door open and take a look at what's actually happening in the world of super PACs, especially with those two. Who's collecting the most? How much are they collecting? Let's break it down.
Okay. The pro-Romney super PAC, Restore Our Future, is collecting more money than the pro-Obama super PAC. And so the study looks at the impact that these super PACs are having on the campaign. And what we found is that these outside groups are spending twice as much to support Romney than Obama. And the second thing we found, and this is going to be of no surprise to your listeners, particularly the ones that live in Virginia, that what these super PACs are spending their money on is TV ads.
Right, right. The interesting thing about that is, having been in radio for a while, these campaign ads, these agencies typically walk in on a Wednesday and go, here's a pile of cash. You, Mr. Radio Advertiser Ad Executive, take this money and run my ads. And money talks. Those things get, commercials get bumped all the time.
Yes.
Because these super PACs or whoever is representing the campaign message at that point, they come walking in with just tons of cash. And like I said, people get bumped all the time to in favor of that message, which is why you hear so many of them.
Yes, sure.
On a regular basis.
We're going to be inundated between now and November 6th.
And there are states, it's obviously, you mentioned Virginia. People might hear that the Romney camp Political Action Committee is spending twice as much as the Obama camp Political Action Committee. But they're not necessarily seeing that in their neighborhood. Like for me, for example, I live in Virginia, and I'd say, I live in Maryland. Maryland, yeah. And it's about 50-50, if you ask me. I can say honestly that I don't see more of one than I do of the other. But it's in Florida, especially during the convention, they're saying that more campaign ads were run down there than ever in history when you look at the campaign financing and such going on. So I guess I want to talk to you about corporations. I know you mentioned corporations previously in your last study. They didn't really step up to the plate. Have they done so this time around?
No. So far, they're not really stepping up to the plate. Individuals are still by far the largest contributors to super PACs.
People with deep pockets, I'm guessing.
Yes. And the interesting thing is, you know, when you look at the corporations that are donating, you know, for example, Oxbow Carbon, the Renko Group, they each recently gave $1 million to restore our future. And I'm sure you're thinking, who are these companies? I've never heard of them.
I'm thinking the Oxbow Incident, but that was a book. So
slightly different. So the interesting thing about the companies that are donating to super PACs is that they are mostly private corporations. Mm-hmm. So aside from their websites, you know, there isn't much we know about these companies. You know, the ExxonMobils of the world are publicly traded. They have to disclose certain things about themselves. But these privately owned firms, you know, we have no idea who they are, what they do, who's running them. And those are the guys that are really donating to the super PACs.
Interesting. I turn to you, Peter Brusso, Dr. Peter Brusso. Over the years, obviously, finances come, finances go. Has anything changed from 2008 to 2012?
Well, one of the dramatic things, in 2008, Senator Obama's campaign fundraising operation was the best in the country. He raised an astronomical amount of money. But right now, Obama's not doing nearly as well as he was doing in 2008. So right now he's just raised over $350 million. This time last year, he had over $400 million in the bank. $50 million makes a huge difference when you consider candidate travel,
sure,
candidate messaging, getting out your materials out there.
So here's an interesting question. You may not be able to answer this, but it just clicked when you said that. The president travels, obviously, in Air Force One.
Yes.
If he's doing a campaign trip, does that get paid for out of his campaign finance money, or is the government still footing the bill?
So that's actually a really great question, particularly an incumbent president.
Right.
What happens is that the government establishes a rate that the campaign has to pay for Secret Service protection, for other additions, add-ons that campaigns have to endure.
So at the end of the month, they look at his calendar and go, okay, this is interesting.
Right. And one of the biggest problems that you, of course, have is, how do you tell the difference between a campaign trip and a visit by the President of the United States?
Especially when they're intermingled so frequently.
Right. So if President Obama comes to Virginia, and I think he's going to be in Woodbridge either sometime this week, talking about defense issues, is it a campaign event or is it a, I'm president of the United States and I'm going out to talk to my people?
So the amount of money that he raised over the course of time from 2008 to 2012, obviously about $50 million short from where he was about 4 years ago. To what do you attribute this change?
There's two big things. In 2008, the Democrats had a very bruising primary. Senator Hillary Clinton is a prodigious fundraiser, and she raised an astronomical amount of money. Obama was able to play off of her and say, you know, she's raising this, I need you to give me money. And so by having a good quality primary challenger who's able to drive up donations to his campaign without having a foil to play against until he had Mitt Romney as the nominee, it was very difficult for him to sort of raise the cash. The other thing we're noticing is a huge change in Wall Street donations. Wall Street was a big backer of the president in 2008. In 2012, we're not seeing that.
Interesting. Anybody in particular that may or may not have stepped up to the plate this time around?
Yeah, some really big names that anyone familiar with Wall Street would probably know. Goldman Sachs in 2008 gave the president over $500,000. Right now, they give him $30,000. Citigroup in 2008 gave over $300,000. Right now, they're giving $30,000 to the president.
So corporations, as we were talking to Melissa, haven't really stepped up to the plate in previous years. Obviously, corporations do come out of the woodwork and go, you know what? I want to back this guy. I want to back this woman. I want to.
Their employees do.
Excuse me, I take that back. You're correct. Right. Their employees do, but the contributions are all public information, so you can attribute them to a person who works for a particular company.
Yes.
Has there been a shift at all? I mean, obviously corporations aren't stepping up. Employees may, to the corporations maybe, but have there been any other changes?
Not generally. One of the things we've seen is a disinterest in donations. When Senator Obama ran in 2008, a lot of new donors came out who'd never donated to a campaign before.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that was very ingenious that the Obama for America campaign did is when you bought campaign swag, for lack of a better word, you'd wind up making a donation. So mm-hmm. if the T-shirt cost you $10, $2 was a campaign donation, $6 went to go pay the manufacturer, and $2 was the shipping and handling. So every time people were buying Obama shirts or buying the Obama Hope poster, they were in fact making a campaign contribution.
So talking a lot about Obama, let's shift gears and move over to the Republican side and Mitt Romney. Who's giving him money? What do we have over on that side?
So when you ask for donations, you usually ask people who you know you've done business with.
Right.
Mitt Romney is a very successful venture capitalist at Bain Capital. And so not surprising, most of his donations are coming from Wall Street firms.
I was just about to say, I would imagine a lot of it's coming from Wall Street.
Of his top 10 donors, the only one that is not a Wall Street firm is Kirkland & Ellis. But all the usual players are there. You wind up seeing Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Barclays, Credit Suisse, the Citigroup, et cetera, are all donating actively to Governor Romney.
Let's talk FEC reports. New ones coming out shortly. Any surprises?
You know, so the new FEC report should be followed on Thursday. We're looking forward to see what's going on in there. One of the things we expect to see is when Mitt Romney made the announcement that Congressman Paul Ryan from Wisconsin would be his vice president, we would expect to see a huge bump of contributions from the more conservative wing of the Republican Party. BGov did a study looking at primary donors. And it turns out of the Republican primary donors, only 54%, one out of two, actually gave money to Mitt Romney. The other 46% supported some other candidate, and they had yet to make a donation to the candidate. What we're expecting to see is now that Paul Ryan, very reliable conservative, beloved by both the Tea Party and other conservative elements within the Republican Party, mm-hmm. we expect to see more money pour into the Romney-Ryan campaign, and we see a huge boost from there.
What about Todd Akin? Any activity going on over there? You make a face. You make a face. What is that?
So Todd Akin's an interesting situation. I won't get into the gaffe, but he made a gaffe. And we've heard conflicting reports. We've heard that campaign donations are drying up. We've also heard that from more of the conservative Christian right elements that as a token of support of the congressman that they're pouring money into the Missouri Senate race. Unfortunately, we just don't know yet because of the Senate electronic filing.
Mm-hmm.
The Senate doesn't file as often as presidential candidates do. And when they do file, they actually don't do electronic filing.
Why?
it's considered a privilege of the Senate.
Okay.
So every single campaign, if you ran for city council in New York City to president of the United States or you run a PAC, you have to file electronically. The Senate still has the option of printing out their reports.
Mm-hmm.
So literally they hit print on electronic documents in the first place, turn over all these paper documents to the Secretary of the Senate. Secretary of the Senate turns to the FEC. The FEC then spends hundreds of thousands of dollars of taxpayer money converting what was originally electronic documents that are now paper documents back to electronic documents. We probably have no idea what actually happens in the Missouri Senate race in terms of financing until late October, if not early November, which is a really, really long time to be waiting for accurate campaign finance data.
Yeah, it is.
And the Senate could easily change it, but for whatever reason, they're deciding to not do it.
All right. Very good. His name is Dr. Peter Brusso. Her name is Melissa Avstray. Thank you very much for joining me. All of their works can be found on bgov.com. Thanks to Kevin Brancato and Matthew Hummer as well for joining me. Don't forget to watch Bloomberg Government's TV show Capital Gains, hosted by veteran correspondent Peter Cook, who brings with him years of experience in Washington, D.C. reporting on the issues that matter with the people that matter every Sunday right after Face the Nation on WUSA TV 9. Follow us on Twitter at BloombergGov, and we'll do this again next Thursday at 11. Plenty more to say about the business implications of government actions right here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.